is usually what happens in my experience. Hello, everyone.
Hello.
We could just start, I suppose.
Yeah.
What the hell?
I'm all ready.
According to Instagram, I'm the inimitable at Bill, B-I-L. Cut off. Like to tweet. I'm Bill Thompson, and it is my great pleasure to be speaking to you all here today. And I'm going to sit down and stop at 2 o'clock to give Gavin 30 minutes. And then if he finishes before 2:30, we'll have an argument. And if he doesn't, we'll have the argument outside. Yeah, it seems reasonable. So I thought I'd start with my favourite joke in the whole world at the moment, which I've told so many people, so many of you will know it already. But it goes like this. There are 10 sorts of person in the world. Oops. People are counting base 10, people are counting base 2, and people who weren't expecting a base 3 joke. They did. So now I know who you are. I called this the State of the Intersection because it's a joke about Barack Obama's State of the Union address, but also expresses the fact that we don't have a union. What we do have is the intersection between the real and the virtual, if you like, between the online and the offline, between the world mediated by technology and the world that is solely mediated by our organic senses. And many of us live in this intersection now. Our smartphones, our devices, our easy and affordable access to the internet, our privileged position at the top of the information tree, just as we're privileged and have a position at the top of the food tree, and the jobs tree, and the housing tree, and the clean water, and the life expectancy trees, all those things that make the game of life so much easier. Our position there gives us a very useful and important perspective, and we need to ensure that we do not blow it. And this is a quote that John Norton, the very estimable John Norton, picked up from John Carey's recent review of a book about ballooning, where he says the nearest modern parallel to ballooning might turn out to be the internet as a means for humanity to exhibit its insatiable appetite for triviality and destruction. Although, you know, it's a good, nice line, you know, it's got a joke in it, it looks quite appealing, but what is really going on? And I think what's really going on is not so much the appetite for triviality and destruction that the internet allows us to demonstrate, but the appetite for power-crazed exploitation of our fellow human beings and the ability of some who consider themselves more privileged or just happen to find themselves in a position of power to do enormous damage. And my fear that we, everyone in this room, are helping them, everyone not in this room, in that process. That is, it's not that the internet may be trivial that's the problem, but that it is founded on principles which leave the things we are building open to exploitation and appropriation by those who would see openness as an opportunity to take without paying. And in that, I do not mean the people who download music for free. I mean the venture capitalists, the startups, and the big tech funds who have built their empires in the commons and are starting to argue that their right to build fences and walls is just another aspect of openness. It's 20 years since CERN agreed with Tim Biel and let him release the code base for the web, and in that 20 years we've been done enormous things. We've created the modern online era, but now we've got Eric Schmidt pushing a technological determinist manifesto that is quite chilling in its inability to take account of the real human needs of society, that wants to put people like him in complete charge, like Platonic philosopher kings. Or we've got Evgeny Morozov calling it for the oppressors, unless we step aside from the internet exceptionalism that we all seem to express and our overarching desire to look on the bright side. Here in the UK, we have UKIP as flavour of the month. We have xenophobia in politics once again reaching the ascendancy, and TweetDeck no longer supports Facebook integration. So, you know, the world is in a really bad way. And the core principles that we espouse, again, I'm using this we, of free software and open standards and open data, all exemplified by the man sitting next to me who's taken a significant chunk of government money to make the world more open and accessible, leave us weak and exposed when we come up against those who don't feel the same way and who would expropriate our work, use the force of copyright and patent law against us, and turn our co-creators into sharecroppers on their cotton plantations. We are as defenceless as Earth facing a Kardashev type 3 civilization when it comes to the people who work for the big banks and the venture capitalist fund. And we may have found ourselves in a post-Shirky world in which those organizations that kept on organizing with organizations like Google, Facebook, and the Conservative Party can trample all over our dearly held sensibilities and turn our plans to nothing. We're living in the future. We are living in the future. The rest of the world is still in 2013, where the economy is fucked, the social fabric is being unravelled, and some people seriously believe that the UK should leave the EU. We have a problem, because living in the intersection as we do, we're in great danger of becoming completely divorced from the political and financial reality that actually determines what is done with the great ideas we have, what use is made of the data sets we open, what our free software is used to deliver, and who eventually benefits. And I'm concerned, deeply concerned, that it may not be the people I care for. And that's not us in this room. It is the poor and dispossessed of the world who have been shafted so many times in the past. It would be a real shame if open data was just another way to diminish their life expectancy. So, what are we going to do? We all do great stuff that changes the world, but we remain pretty naive about the world that is changed by that, about how we engage with it. We create open licenses, and open licenses are fantastic, but their very freedom allows those who don't share our values to do things we might not agree with, and we often don't have a space to have the discourse and the debate. If the Nazipedia started tomorrow, what would you do about it? Would we want to do anything about it? Should we do anything about it? What would be the issue there if they take stuff that CC0 released and use it for their own purposes? Under the license, there is no issue. Politically, we would object. Where and how? I think we have to ask what level of social and political engagement is becoming appropriate if you're a hacker. And we have to say that it's not enough just to believe in social justice and enlightenment values and an open society, which I'm assuming you all do, because, hey, you're my friends, and I love you all dearly. It's not enough just to believe in those things and then restrict your online activism to the odd Facebook like and a petition, that we're reaching the point where we really need to reach out and do stuff. Like many other people, I've been watching Breaking Bad. And as you well know, Breaking Bad is the story of Walter White, a shy, retiring chemistry teacher who, on discovering he has cancer, and I'm not going to give too many plot spoilers, don't worry, on discovering he has cancer, decides he needs to make money for his family, so starts manufacturing crystal meth to make millions of dollars. It's a good strategy. Now, Walter doesn't make crystal meth just to get money, but that's obviously the proximal cause of it. There's also, and it's clear as the character evolves, it's a way for him to gain respect from other people, some of them rather nasty people, and to express a darker side of his character. And I would argue, come back to me when you got to series 4, that dark side was always there, but we can have that discussion later. But the other thing is that Walter wants to do it right. It is important to him that his crystal meth is 99% pure. He goes to enormous efforts to make the best crystal meth ever, because it matters to him. And so he chooses not to see that his quality product is killing people and damaging lives because it sits at the heart of a system that's based on violence, exploitation, and addiction. So it may not be that our desire to sort the net out or make HTML5 perfect or release open data sets is going to make the world as bad as pure meth does. It might be that it's worse. The question is whether what we're going to result with is a closed economy and a closed society built on open data. The question is whether we're going to end up being the useful idiots, in Stalin's terms, in the Silicon Valley ideology, where we build our cool toys and we leave them open to appropriation like those punk bands whose songs completely failed to threaten the system back in the 1970s. Because the digital revolution, like most other revolutions, is likely to result in the aristocracy being overthrown by the bourgeoisie and the workers getting screwed again, meet the new OS, same as the old OS. But we have a choice. We made the network. We created the model for open data, and we can change it. If you read Karl Popper, The Open Society and His Enemies, for him the real problem is historicism. It is the belief that some characteristics of human society are innate and essential and unchangeable, and that as a result, something's just become inevitable. You can't challenge it. But we know we made it all up as we go along, because many of us in this room made the stuff up in the first place. We had the ideas, we thought the thoughts. And we were not channeling a platonic world of forms when we did that. We came up with brilliant ideas for how websites might work, for how streaming audio and video might work, for what open data structures might be appropriate, for what licenses, those licenses were written not just by people like you and me, but by you and me. So we can't claim that the internet is an external reality which somehow has an essential nature that can't be challenged. We don't need to. We are the people who know that better than anyone. And firstly, that gives us a responsibility for what happens that we cannot deny. We cannot put this on anyone else, okay? We, the geeks, the technicians, the developers, we built this world, and therefore how it plays out is up to us. But it also means we have the power to reshape it if we want to, and if we haven't left it too late. I don't know if Dave Green is in the room, but NTK famously says, they stole our revolution, now we want it back. That was 15 years ago, well, I think the time might have arrived. Google took href and turned it into their business. Facebook took HTML5 and figured out a way to close it, to lock it off to people. What are we going to lose next in the liminal space? What are the things that will become impossible for us because we have built tools that can be used by our enemies, and yes, they are our enemies, to close things down? What are those toiling in the public service going to do when the things they believe are valuable and important become impossible because of a patent thicket or because somebody somewhere has figured out a way to take the open data, lock it away, and use it in ways we did not imagine or we didn't want? How do we put social justice at the heart of everything we build? And how do we consider the social impact of what we do in advance of this happening? Part of the problem is that too few of us have any politics. As in, politics on the ground. We don't do those things. Politics has become debased. It's not important. It's not interesting. Look at the coalition. Look at the Labour Party. Who would you want to campaign for? The politicians, they don't know what they're doing. Well, if they don't know what they're doing, partly that's because we haven't told them. And if the political parties don't properly express an interest in these issues, that's because we have chosen not to share our concerns with them or to share the understanding that they need. We have advocacy organisations. We have great groups like Open Rights Group, founded here, ODI, EFF, FIPPR, Mozilla, everyone. It is possible for that sort of advocacy and influence and activism to happen, and it is happening in some small places, but not nearly enough. The EFF does not have enough armoured divisions, if you ask me. We could do something about that. Armoured with ideology, obviously, or 3D printed tanks. A big part of the problem, of course, is that the framework is not amenable to the outcomes we'd like to see. That legal, regulatory, political, financial frameworks are all oriented towards a different set of goals and outcomes. If you're a venture capital fund, if you're a bank, if you're a corporation, everything is designed to your advantage. If you're a small startup trying to make money out of open data and open systems, it is incredibly difficult. So I'm not claiming this is easy. But I'm the sort of person, I have to admit, who's used to having agency in the world. I'm white, I'm male, I'm able-bodied, I'm heterosexually inclined, I'm well-educated, and I've had and been able to take advantage of opportunities denied all but a tiny proportion of the humans who ever lived. I grew up on the toughest council estate in Corby. Corby. It's not exactly Sao Paulo or Cabira, is it? Okay? Even what I might consider my hard working class origins was sufficiently privileged to put me above the vast majority of humans. And so I'm the sort of person, white middle-aged man, who likes to think of things to do. You know, to be is to do. We have to act. We have to do something. Apart from obviously writing English blog posts or books, because that's the easy way. And we don't want to stay where we are, so I'd like to suggest that we think of things that we could do. And it seems to me there is a choice that we can make. One option open to us is direct confrontation. We are the clever people in the room. Okay? So if they're taking our ideas, let's make it hard. They want patent thickets, let's give them a forest. They want the DCMA, let's close off future edits to Wikipedia, hit them with takedown notices. Let's build DRM into Mozilla, enforce our view of the world, trademark everything, and announce CC Max with added litigation. We could just take them on. If we withdrew our consent completely, then they'd find it very hard to survive. Or not. I mean, I think I'd rather not do that. I'm not actually looking for confrontation. Like Gandhi, I don't think that a victory worth winning with those weapons would be worth having. Yeah? Power corrupts, copyright power corrupts. Using it for good would be hard. And though Stallman may have come back purified from his battle with the Balrog, we don't want to have to use that staff of power. See, there's a reason Gandalf didn't just get the eagles to fly Frodo and Sam into Mordor. It showed that the small and weak can change things too, and they don't just have to be helped by white men with beards. And this is an important lesson for us all. I think we need our own salt march. I think we need to take the users with us, and the kids who are just learning to code with young rewired states and code clubs and everywhere else, and we need to practice peaceful, non-violent resistance and refuse to participate, even if it brings with it a personal cost. We need to find a way to do that, to offer other models. We have inspirational models. We've got the Mozilla Foundation. We know how this could look if we did it right, but we need to embed that into our thinking, and we need to be willing to make sacrifices in order to allow that to happen. And that may mean individual sacrifices in not doing deals, in not having jobs, in not signing up for things. I don't want to abandon our principles, and I don't want to abandon the technology. But I do want to consider, and I want all of us to consider, how new technologies have been pressed into the service of the ruling classes and the elites throughout history, and ask how the systems that we're building, the data sets we're liberating, and the principles that we espouse can be used to increase social justice, to reduce inequality and oppression, and to serve the mass of humanity and not just the wealthy superclass. And I'd like to finish by asking you to reflect on the Luddites. Because the Luddites weren't ever opposed to technology, and they used some of the most advanced cloth-making techniques of their time. They revolted because the new forms of automation that were introduced in the early 19th century were amenable to industrial organisation and required such an investment of capital to buy and install that factory working was the only way to make them profitable. And they fought because the capitalist mill owners and their political friends used their political influence to change the rules to their advantage. For the Luddites, that was reducing the power of the guilds over the ways cloth and wool were made and manufactured. It's just the same as the way rules on personal privacy get diluted to make it possible for Facebook to triumph. The Luddites lost. Can we do any better? Thank you.
Thanks, Bill. No challenge there, then. Okay, my name's Gavin Starks. I'd like to talk around the theme of beyond open data, and it's quite interesting because with all the open tech talks that I've given, I think the title has always been decided for me by Sam and the organisers, because I never can make up my mind. But what I'd like to start with is just a bit of nostalgia, so if you indulge me here, a little bit about how things grow. And I think this is really an important point, and one that I just want to reflect on. 9 years ago, there was an event which started called NotCon, and it was a collection of people getting together exactly like we are today. And when I look back at the agenda for that event, there were some interesting things that I could pick out from that. There were some people, Matt Jones, Tom Steinberg, Bill Thompson, Bruce Kale, Danny O'Brien, Corey Doctorow, Wendy Grossman, and I was in there as well. And I'm just picking out a few there just because I happen to know them, but I think there's a theme here of those people are still active. Wendy is sitting just in the corner there. Bill is obviously here. A lot of us are sitting here in the first place because of the work that Tom Steinberg has done. And I think much to the theme from earlier, it does take a long time to get there. And when you look at what's happened since then, we've had Sue Charman, Paula LeDuc, Rufus talking about practical open content. Ben Hammersley on the future is open, or it should be, 2005. We had to wait a little while for the next one. But then your open rights group, Jenny Tennyson on power of information, Jonathan Gray on CCAN, The Guardian building an open web. 2009, Heather Brook talking about MPs' expenses, the open internet, John Sheridan on opening government data. So we've got this long heritage of being open. Through to 2010, Richard Stirling and many friends, as we've heard today, on data.gov.uk. Lisa Evans opening up, where does my money go? And up to 2011, we've got Hadley Beeman on LinkAlp and Bill talking about building digital futures. Then we had to wait a little while the Olympics passed, and here we are. But look at the heritage that we're building on here. This is decades worth of work, and I think it's really important, and why I was so delighted last year when the Open Data Institute was announced. And I think the theme that I really want to bring forward today, and very much building on our incredible coordination between our presentations, which we always do, of open as the new default, and the Open Data Institute, which is now 6 months old, and I'll give a bit of an update on what we've been doing over the last 6 months. But one of the things I think I found most surprising was this bit. I feel incredibly privileged to be in a position where I'm running the Open Data Institute, and actually sponsoring today's event was one of the easiest decisions I could have possibly made, to say what community has existed over the last 9 years that we can support. This is a natural thing for the Open Data Institute to be supporting. I want to zip back now to a slide which some of you may recognise from previous years when I was running my previous company called the Avoiding Mass Extinctions Engine, looking at what the potential futures are, and you know, very much to the point you were making about, you know, what future are we heading for? Is it a dystopian future, or are we actually trying to create some different frame of reference? Is it the case that in the beyond open data that we will be in a wonderful dystopian future, or will it actually be a bit like it was in 2004, where we all get together, have some really interesting conversations, make really powerful stuff, and adjourn to the pub later, with significant apologies to Danny O'Brien here for gratuitous use of photo, and this is after the 2004 NotCon. So what have we actually done? So this was the ODI in September. In our first week, we bought some bins, and we bought some coffee, and we started talking to some investors. This is what it looks like today, so we've got an amazing space. Now, we've brought together lots of different people, from school kids to get them trained in how to use data, the fact that data is available and usable. And we've had a huge selection of people through, from Dave Willits talking to Tim Berners-Lee on a TV screen, to people falling off their parkour walls or whatever and breaking their arms, to wearing robotic bunny ears, etc. So we've had a huge number of people through the space, and I think this is one of the things that I've really found most significant, is this has not just been about us coming together, it's been about completely different sets of people coming together. We have convened people completely outside the tech sphere and completely outside the kind of normal community, and helped to bring them together. I'd like to talk a little bit about why I think open data is important, and I think very much building on some of the work that I've done over the last 6 or 7 years in the environmental space, looking at how could we use information to improve environmental assessment. I actually want to try and broaden that remit to everything, and I think we can address some of the greatest challenges of our time. And the mission of the ODI is about taking what we're already doing, culture of open data that exists, helping to catalyze it, to create economic, social, and environmental value for everyone. And I think then unpacking that into what do we mean by social, economic, environmental data, there's many pieces here that we can learn from. So whether it's Al Gore looking at the internet changing the way that we think, from my point of view, ubiquitous data will change, does change human behaviour quite fundamentally. We've got transformation of products to services. We can scale our existing services quite radically. We can radically improve data-driven decision-making. I think the notion of political decisions being made by ideology or preference or whatever we call it, anecdata, is something we really need to move forward from. And if you consider David Cameron having an iPad app with some national statistics on it, wouldn't it be a good idea if we all had access to the same data and understood its provenance? And I think we can build entirely new interactions, whether that's looking at population growth, population management, whether it's our education, our legal systems, our transportation, looking at our own personal data shadows from our devices and our ambient information that we're providing to large private companies already. How does that interface with the public sphere? How does that interface with the GDSs of the world? As we move forward and start opening up information in a public sphere and through the private sector. This is an artwork that sits in our office. It's a reconfiguration of London, remapped as if the tube map were real. So if you like, this is the mental map that everybody has of London, based on the tube map. And I think it's important to recognise that as we come up with these fantastic visualisations and ways of translating data into things that have that speak to many people, that we're careful about what that transformation is. The mental map of London for every single tourist that has ever been here looks like this, because the tube map is their point of reference. When we look at environmental data, you know, if you've heard me speak at OpenTech before, I've given some very, very dark presentations about the end of the world. Nicholas Stern, who wrote the Stern Report, has now more recently come out and said actually it's much worse. But I won't go there today. What I will say is we've got new energy markets. There's a new form of energy supply coming to the mainstream, and that is in microgeneration, collaborative purchasing, and many of the tools that we're now seeing useful in the web sphere being useful in the procurement of energy and related services. So we can actively address those pieces. We can actively address some of the resource challenges we have. We need to open up information about our supply chains. And when you look at the range of, you know, what data could we make open here in the environment, well, there's obvious things like our geographic data to help us with maps. And we've been quite vocal at the ODI around the postcode address part, for example, which is going to be sold off as part of the Royal Mail privatisation, which is a terrible idea. The weather information, how do you bring these things together with our pollution data, with our resource scarcity? I was speaking with the insurance industry recently and said, you know, what do you think the value of open data could be to the risk assessment business? So when you're looking at environmental risks, shipping, supply chains, etc. And they said, oh, it's probably somewhere between 10 and 100 billion pounds. I was like, that's quite a big number. And helping to translate what is the power of open data into financial terms to somebody who's sitting on the trading floor at Lloyd's is a very powerful mechanism. And we need to create these kind of feedback loops to exactly Bill's point of how can we translate between these different systems and have some influence. One of the other artworks we've got sitting in our office is called Text Trends, which looks at just different Google text trend searches. So this is the number of searches for the word summer versus the number of searches for the word winter over the past decade. And you can see the periodicity there. So you can actually tell when the seasons are by what people are searching for. There's a similar one for the searches for Obama versus Romney. And you could have easily predicted the election results based on that data. When you look at economic value, the Open Government Partnership, which we're chairing at the moment, has stated that they believe transparency will drive prosperity. And I think there's a lot of different pieces here, which some of which are contentious, some of which are not. But one of the important points, if you think back 20 years, who would have predicted that the internet would be 10% of our GDP? I don't think anybody. And we're looking at, from my perspective, the same scale of change with open data and the other open systems that we are building. What is this going to be worth to our economy in the next 10 to 20 years? One of the big differences between, say, the mid-90s web and today, and it has taken us 20 years to get here, is that we've already done the plumbing. We already have ubiquitous broadband. We already have devices in everybody's hands where we can deliver these services. So we've already got the infrastructure to push these services out. So how can we shorten the path? And one of the advantages I think we have, to Bill's point of, well, we understand how all of this is put together, is we can move faster than anybody else. And so the faster we can move in to help define some of the rules to make sure the systems that we're building are open, the more likely they are to become the state of the nation. When we look at what types of economic data, it could be tax, it could be corporate ownership. I've been very, surprised is probably the best word, that the kind of organisations that have been coming to the ODI to say how could the ODI help them have included HMRC, have included the Bank of England. How could the Bank of England open up more information? Well, actually, that's quite a profound set of questions. And if we can open up those kind of pieces of information, we can help to create some transformative change. The same goes for procurement. We've worked with GDS and Liam Maxwell, who's the CTO there, to embed open data in the procurement roles. So one of the forcing functions, if you like. If you want to be hired by a government, then your contractual information will be open data. So that's the amount of the contract, its terms, the service level agreement, etc. And any data that you produce also has to be open data. We're now working on, well, how could we take that a step forward so that you have to consume open data as well as producing it if you have a government contract. These are quite powerful instruments of change. The G-Cloud framework, which if you are a small business in the UK, please get onto the G-Cloud framework. It's about £150 million worth of spend going through it at the moment. That's going to rise to £1 billion a year. And the amount of savings that brings to us as citizens, Tom gave an example earlier. Anecdotally, I've heard between 50 and 90% savings for typical IT contracts within government when they're outsourced to a domestic small business. On that theme, we have another artwork in our space, which is a vending machine, and this vending machine only dispenses a snack when the recession gets worse. So very popular, because it dispenses snacks pretty much all the time. you can't buy any snacks from it, but during the budget announcements we came in, and it dispenses some tar contents. So we'd love to get this installed at the Treasury for its next bit of its tour. So what are we doing at the Open Data Institute? So quick overview. I think we'd love to hear from everybody in this room about what we're doing and help shape what we're building. We're trying to respond to what we see and what we hear from people. The first thing that we heard was, we're really interested in open data, but we don't know where to begin. So we've designed a number of training courses to help people begin. We've then heard from people, well, we now know what we'd like to do, but we don't know how to do it. Can you help us? So we've got some professional services where we can provide research and development. And the third thing that we've heard, big companies say, show us where are the innovators. And we've heard small companies say, can you connect us to the big companies? So we've got a startup program that helps matchmake between those two things. So we're working on standards and research on training, we're incubating businesses, and we're trying to tell the story afterwards. I think this is a really important point that I don't think we've done a very good job of collectively, is in order to tell the stories outside of our community, to tell them to politicians in a non-threatening way, to tell them to the general public in a way that inspires, is going to need a lot more work from all of us. Quick background about our own sort of financial status, and I think very much to Bill's point, these are my weapons. Funding are part of my arsenal of how do we get things done. We have got £10 million committed from the public sector through the Technology Strategy Board, but we are a non-profit independent company. Our board does not have any of our investors as members. So our board is Tim Berners-Lee, Nigel Shadbolt, myself, and two other non-exec directors. We also managed to raise £500,000 from a Midiar Network, which is a philanthropic fund, to look at how we can expand internationally. And we've also unlocked a couple of £1 million worth of funding for startups and for innovation that is not money for us, it's for us to give directly to people with ideas. And we've signed a 2-year deal with the World Bank to help train the world's political and national leaders so they can create their own open data strategies. So this is joining, for me, the grassroots with the top down. How do we help to span those divides? How do we communicate to politicians who are struggling to understand, frankly, anything to do with the web in many cases, and get them to the point where they understand the power of open as a fundamental part of our society? We've got 6 startups in the in-house at the moment. We've got 10 private companies as members. It includes Virgin Media, which association. Virgin came to us with data that they want to open, but all the DNS records from their services. How can they make that open without compromising privacy, but how does it stimulate innovation? And as I mentioned, we brought together lots of different organisations. My society sit in our space. We've brought together governments, private companies, and individuals. The startup programme, which we launched a couple of months ago, we had about 18 people apply for, and we've selected 6 so far out of that. And we're really keen to get people to the point where they're sustainable businesses. We're not like a normal accelerator or incubator, where we're just trying to get an exit that is a venture-backed exit where you float and sell off to some US company. The metrics here are about how do you create social, environmental, or economic value. And if you can create all 3 of those things, so much the better. Some of the startups we have in-house at the moment include Open Corporates, which you'll see Chris Taggart mentioned on the very first slide. They've got data for about 50 million companies. We've got Placer, which has got all of the transport data in the UK, and Mastodon, you heard present earlier this morning on this project, which is a fantastic example. This highlighted 2 things to me. One, that there are examples out there that are easy to find and easy to communicate. So the Mastodon team with Ben Goldacre and healthcare professionals looked at all the open data around prescriptions, and within a few weeks, found a potential £200 million saving for the NHS. We then engaged with that partly to help fund it, again, a small amount of investment, but most importantly, to help communicate that to as broad an audience as possible. This could have gone down the road of Newsnight doorstopping doctors to say, which drugs company are you taking a backhander from, which would not have been a very collaborative process or resulted in a lot of good future-looking work. What we did do is we got a very thoughtful piece in The Economist, then in the Financial Times, and then it got covered by the rest of the media. So by the time it hit the red tops, it was still a story about how can we collaborate around a problem rather than just throwing stones at each other for not doing our jobs properly. But this is still the beginning of a story. What we have to do now, and we are doing now, is helping them to raise money to turn this whole analytics process into a software-as-a-service business. So the insight can be provided for all drug classes on an ongoing basis. And because all the data is open data in the first place, when that intervention program kicks in, we'll be able to track on a monthly basis of whether or not it's working and adapt based on those results. So I think it's a very powerful story. We will be commissioning films around this to try and communicate the story more broadly and stop talking about data and start talking about benefits. So just before we go on there, the other thing that this story really highlighted to me is that we haven't got enough good stories. The fact that this story got picked up by everybody, not just in the UK, but it flew around the world. I sat down with the Japanese government a couple of months ago, and they'd already heard about this. To me, that told me that we don't have nearly enough powerful stories that can cross the divide out of the tech space, out of the people who understand what we talk about in this room into the sphere where people go, okay, I can understand that there's a benefit here that we should invest in. As I mentioned, we've got corporates engaging. I'm really delighted that large companies and small companies are signing up. We've got the existing leaders in the space, Open Knowledge Foundation, My Society, very much engaged in what we're doing. But this is also about countries. So when we think about open as the new default, this is coming from everywhere. It's not a grassroots thing, it's a corporate thing. It's an NGO thing, and it's a country thing. And most recently, just in the last week, Obama has given an executive order in the US for making open and machine readable the new default for government information. This is a really significant step forward for the US. And we're in fortnightly conversations at the moment with the White House about how we can engage in helping them achieve that. And similarly, there are dozens of countries and hundreds of regions around the world starting to release open data. Now, they're doing it in maybe not the best of ways to begin with, but at least they're trying, maybe apart from Russia, who yesterday pulled out of the Open Government Partnership. Apparently they don't want to be as transparent as they previously committed to. But I think that this is an international movement. There are many, many countries and individuals pushing for open data. So just coming back to another artwork here, the image that I showed right at the very first slide. This is a piece that sits in our offices. It's a 3D scan of the artist's body, and he's got sensors around all of South London, bringing in environmental data and representing that in a representation of his own body. And one of the things I love about this is that he won't tell us what the algorithms are. He won't tell us what the transformation is on the data. So you get this sense of, well, there's a quantified amount of ambient information being brought back into an entity here, but we have no idea what its translation is. Just to finish off on how are we being open? So I think there's a lot of benefit in us leading by example. So apart from all of our technical development work being done in the open, we're also starting to do all of our commercial development in the open. So all of our procurement roles, the codification of the Open Data Institute itself as an organization, we're starting to put up on GitHub. That's a very early stage process, and I'm looking for help in doing this. So please get in touch if you can help. We're also taking it a step further, not just having dashboards around our technical development, which you'll quite often see in development teams like at GDS, etc. But we're also doing it for our business. So how can we take a really bold set of steps forward around being very transparent about what we're actually doing in our own progress? So this chart, I'll try not to get into too much detail, but it said that we achieved 91% of the things that we set out to do in Q1 this year. That's a good number for me, because if we'd achieved 100, we'd have set our targets too low. And if it was less than 90, we'd have set our targets too high. So we roughly got most of the things done that we said we'd do. You can see how much revenue we've booked. We can see how far we are through our own investor metrics. And there's another tier down here, which we'll be opening up over the coming months, of what are we actually doing? What's our own work plan? So how can we turn our organization inside out? And again, really looking for input and any learning that people can bring. But this is just a screenshot of our internal to-do list. And I want to start making versions of this open without breaching any confidentiality or personal information. We can give a sense of what we're doing as an organization. One of the pieces of research work, again, hearing from the community, what would be the most useful thing that we could build? Well, something that helps with the discoverability of open data and with the understanding the quality of that data itself. So we've created a thing called an open data certificate that's going to be going into beta at the end of this month. All the development's being done on GitHub itself. If you've already worked with open data, you may have come across Tim Berners-Lee's 5-star rating system. Effectively, this takes it a stage further and turns it into a codified programmatic rating system. So it looks at the licensing and the structure and the continuity of supply of the data itself. So it can sit on top of existing systems like CCAN. In fact, if you're using CCAN, you'll probably have 70 or 80% of the information you need. The outcome of this will be that individuals can discover data and have an understanding of how long that data is going to last, and is it really licensed in a way that makes it reusable. So please get involved in that project if you are interested. And just to finish off, there's a final piece here, which I'll just play a short video of. It sits in our office. And this piece called the Obelisk brings together or searches the web for terms related to the Nuremberg trials. So crimes against humanity, crimes of war, crimes of aggression, and genocide. And the pulsing of each face of the obelisk changes frequency based on the a number of times search terms are found. So this piece sitting in the middle of our office, if you like, acts as a lighthouse, as a beacon to remind us of the global sentiment that we are revealing as a species by looking at across a whole range of different sites. And just to finish then, one of the my favourite things that was written on the blackboards in the ODI was that open will always triumph, Bill.
Yeah,
triumph over closed.